Elijah, there is a connection between our first interview that aired with Mrs. Anderson and the interview that we're going to air now with Peter Guralnick. And that is one of the holy grails of American music, Robert Johnson's guitar. And there's a connection that was made between Mrs. Anderson's family history and Peter's research that I think is really interesting. And it is that Mrs. Anderson remembers that the guitar ended up in the hands of Robert's brother Leroy and was ultimately pawned. Well, Peter unearthed an anecdote, I believe, from Robert Jr. Lockwood, saying that a man came up to Robert Jr. in Handy Park on Beale Street and said, "Come back to my place. Oh, there's something I need to show you." And what the man showed Robert Jr. was Robert's guitar. Well, the man in question was the man who Mrs. Anderson remembered getting away with Robert's guitar, and that was their brother Leroy. On that guitar, you are a guitarist. You know the musical angle the way that I do not. So looking at the photographs of Robert Johnson that we have, the three that have been out, and I don't know if the third one actually sheds any new light on the guitar itself, but is that the same guitar in both of those? It is not.
Even slightly.
Really? Okay.
Very, very different instruments.
Take us through real quick.
I don't really know a lot about the one in the beautiful picture. I haven't looked at that one too closely. The other one I know very well because I actually picked up one that's just like it.
By listening to his recordings, is there any way to match what you hear with what we see in those photos?
That's a funny question. I bought myself a little Kalamazoo, which looked just like the Robert Johnson little Kalamazoo. It looks like it's exactly the same kind of guitar. And when I play it, it seems to me uncanny how much it sounds like his guitar. And I have no idea whether that's just because I wanted to.
No, that's cool though. But
yes, I mean, I think the short answer is, yeah, I mean, it's a little guitar. I think actually the Gibson that he plays is also a little guitar. And that they're very bright. They have a lot of high end. And I think the thing I'd underline is they sound nothing at all like a metal bodied National guitar. And the extent to which people who want to sound like Robert Johnson keep picking up those big metal-bodied resonator guitars rather than getting little wooden-bodied guitars, which is what he in fact played. It's very odd. It's a good example of how, you know, sort of fantasies can crash up against realities.
Ralph Macchio must have played the National Steel. No, but
Son House liked the National Steel. I mean, it's not that it's unsuited to playing. I think, you know, it's much better suited to playing slide, but it doesn't have the sustain. Those have pretty fast sound decay. And if you're thinking of things like Kind-Hearted Woman, that beautiful, rich tone he got. I think it's very connected to the, you know, the Kalamazoo I have definitely sounds like that. The Gibson he's playing in the studio portrait, I haven't sat down with one of those and listened, but it wouldn't surprise me. Those are both beautiful guitars.
So when you spoke previously about the beauty of Robert Johnson's tone, you feel like that's something that you've hit on with your Kalamazoo. So we could have a match there. I don't expect this to be a slam dunk. That's impossible.
I'm not going to overstate that because honestly, someone with the kind of tone that Robert Johnson had or that Lonnie Johnson had or that, you know, the really great old blues guys have, it has a lot more to do with the guy than with the guitar.
Good enough. Well, one more question kind of along those lines. So we're going to go into our interview with Peter Guralnick in just a minute. And one of the things that Peter does that to me really elevated blues music and Robert Johnson in particular as an artist is to frame him not just alongside Son House and Charlie Patton and Lonnie Johnson and Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters, but amongst, you know, Shakespeare and John Donne. And part of our conversation was given over to the artistry of Robert Johnson's lyrics. And it just so happened, Elijah, that after we had our conversation with Peter, I was reading Charles Dickens' Bleak House and came upon the following line. So this is a piece of dialogue from a character who's speaking. He says, "Nothing has been the matter, but here have I been stewing and fuming in this jolly old crib till I have had the horrors falling on me as thick as hail." What do you think about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things that we often forget is quite how deep, not necessarily in Charles Dickens, but how the extent to which Dickens and Donne and Robert Johnson are deep in the language of the King James Bible. You know, there is a poetic strain that is constant. You know, I mean, I think of Robert Johnson saying, "We'll bid you fair farewell." I mean, there's all this Elizabethan phrasing that's still running around in the blues world, and combining with African folk tales. You know, they're putting all of this stuff together, but they have all of that culture at their fingertips.
Peter, at least to me, is the scholar who's most responsible for tearing down these genre walls and remaking this, I guess, universe of artistry where these people really do belong together, as they Absolutely. Realistically do. And so, well, let's...
No, Peter changed my life.
Well, why don't you go into that? I mean, your personal connections to Peter are really interesting to me.
Oh, well, I mean, I mentioned to you earlier the sillier connections, which are that his father removed both my wisdom teeth and my mother's wisdom teeth. So his father was a dental surgeon. And I remember my first hearing about Peter by my mother saying, "Oh, you know, Dr. Guralnick's son likes blues too." But no, when I read Peter's early writing, he was really the first person who ever suggested, at least to me, the possibility that this was all, you know, that Waylon Jennings and Robert Johnson and Elvis Presley and Skip James and, you know, we could go on, Charlie Poole, Doc Boggs, whatever, Billie Holiday, Aretha Franklin, that you can, not only that you can like all of them, but you can like them all for the same reasons. That it's not like I like this in this mood and I like that in that mood. These are things where the genre definitions are just ways of marketing the music, but what the way Robert Johnson touches us can be the same way Shakespeare touches us or Hank Williams touches us.
Is it as profound as the way a dental surgeon touches your impacted wisdom teeth?
At his worst, it's pleasanter than that.
Okay. Well, I hope that listening to this interview is not in any way comparable to pulling teeth. But Peter was kind enough to join us. He has just put out a revised version of his classic essay, Searching for Robert Johnson. So when you hear us referring to that, that's what we're talking about. I reread the piece, which was really the first thing that I read about Robert Johnson as a youth. But having reread it, not only did it hold up very well, but as I said earlier, it connected to points that have been corroborated by other sources since. And so that's one of the themes of our discussion. But let's get to it.
And what did people like Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters have to say about Robert Johnson?
Well, yeah. He did. He each spoke with great admiration of Robert Johnson's work. I heard Howlin' Wolf one night at the Boston Tea Party in 1968, I think. Johnny Littlejohn was in the band then. Actually, Wolf sent S.P. Leary down from the bandstand and had Johnny Littlejohn playing drums with him, which is pretty funny. It was around the time that Johnny Littlejohn's album came out on Our Hooli, which and that I can't date it exactly, but it was around 68, and Wolf got kind of pissed off that people in the audience were calling for songs from Johnny Littlejohn that they had just heard on the album. But Wolf that night sang this epic version of Hellhound on My Trail, which I've never
seen. Oh, my
seen.
God.
I've never seen it alluded to elsewhere. I've never known of him to sing it any other time. And it was his own Hellhound on My Trail, but it was clearly derived from Robert Johnson's. But in the course of it, he was up on the mountain, and he was an old man, you know, making his way down the mountain. And, you know, he was limping, and he was acting it out the way Wolf would do. And it was just, it was the most amazing thing. I mean, I wish I had a, you know, video time machine. But, but so, and he's, you know, sang, he always paid homage to Charlie Patton as well as Jimmy Rogers, something which people should never forget. Jimmy Rogers was one of his primary influences, the father of country music. I mean, not the Muddy Waters guitarist. But he spoke highly of Robert Johnson. And Muddy, of course, would never have spoken of him at all. You can just hear in his songs where his music comes from, both Son House, who was really his primary influence, and Robert Johnson. And he varied between saying he thought he saw Robert Johnson once, he was in the back of the crowd, but he wasn't sure really what he, you know, and other times when he said he didn't see him at all, he just heard his music. But the influence, the impact, you know, is so evident on Muddy Waters' music. And that's, in a sense, what's so weird about the latter-day sort of the revisionist histories, which suggest that, among other things, I mean, and this is a variation on what rock criticism was at one time, or the mainstream was, if a thing isn't popular, how could it be important? Which I think is nuts, but, you know, people have said that. And so revisionist historians have said, well, Robert Johnson's music didn't sell particularly, although it sold pretty well. I mean, the Terraplane sold quite well, actually. But and I say, if Robert Johnson had never made a record, his role in history and his role in music would be just as important, because the music was carried on by a whole generation that could have cared less about, you know, blues collectors, or, you know, a white blues world, or anything like that. People like Muddy Waters and Johnny Shines and Robert Jr. Lockwood and Sonny Boy Williamson and Howlin' Wolf and, you know, Baby Boy Warren and just Elmore James, all of whom carried on the legacy of Robert Johnson, irrespective of what, later generations of blues collectors or people who felt that they discovered Robert Johnson themselves, irrespective of what they think. The music of Robert Johnson was part and parcel of the blues from the time of Robert Johnson on, and it wasn't through his records.
Mm-hmm. I would just add to that, because, I mean, this is something all three of us know, but some people listening here may not, that Robert Johnson was the same age as Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters. I mean, because he died so young, there's a tendency to think of him as, you know, from a previous generation. But he was from that generation, and I think one of his effects was not even musical, but was simply the effect of being someone their age in their world who had traveled to all these places and who had led what was in that world a very exciting life.
I think that's true to a degree, but think about Johnny Shines, who as a kid had just idolized, you know, Howlin' Wolf to the point that he was, you know, called Little Wolf. And he, and, you know, it's I think, enlightening or telling that, you know, Johnny Shines talks about how he thought so highly of Wolf, he thought he must be a magic man. And he must have, you know, rather than driving a tractor during the day or whatever it was he did on the plantation, he must live in a cave and emerge from that cave only at night, you know. And that's how much he idolized. But when he heard Robert Johnson play, and I think the first time, I think it was in Helena, Hughes, Arkansas, but I think it was in Helena that he first heard Robert Johnson. But in any case, when he first heard him, it just turned him around completely. And it didn't turn, mm-hmm. I mean, ultimately the stories he tells are stories of Robert talking, and I think in a sense this grew in Johnny's mind or John's mind to be a greater thing than it may have been in reality. But he said, well, every time I saw him, he'd talk about going off to a recording session, you know, somewhere or some, and that sort of plays into what you're saying, Elijah. But the other thing was that long before that ever happened, long before, you know, Robert Johnson made recordings, it was the music. And it was music that, you know, Johnny Shine said he had never heard that kind of music before. It was of a different degree. It was a different degree of intensity and a different degree of evolution. And even the fact that Robert Johnson could, you know, pick up a song. I mean, it wasn't just that he had a phonographic memory, but that he could pick up a song while half listening, and that he had such a broad repertoire, and that he would sing songs by, you know, Bing Crosby or Tumbling Tumbleweeds or, you know, just this whole variety of music.
Absolutely.
So I don't know about it, or Muddy Waters, for example. He didn't know who Robert Johnson was. He wasn't, you know, impressed by Robert Johnson's travels. It was the music that really got to him. But in other cases, yeah. I'm sure you're right. You know that.
No, you're absolutely right. And I guess I was overstressing the travels. I mean, the ability to play everything. I guess what I'm just saying is, for the people of his generation, he just felt like the breadth of his grasp of the universe, however one wants to frame that, I think was very different in the Delta. And that's one of the things I understood much better after reading Mrs. Anderson's book and talking with her, the extent to which Robert Johnson was in the Delta, but with all the knowledge of somebody who had grown up in Memphis. And I think that that also plays into it, that he simply felt, you know, was able to bring an affinity with urban music that I think was very exciting to all these young people.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, again, the idea of someone who, and this didn't enter into the awareness of the sensibility of people like Johnny Shines and Robert Jr. Lockwood, who, as far as they were concerned, they weren't even, not only were they not aware of the kind of education that Robert had had, but they weren't even aware, they weren't even sure whether he could read or write. Yet here he was, who had gotten, he had gotten a fairly extensive education. He had, you know, he came from a household that devoured the Chicago Defender and, you know, and was well aware of Marcus Garvey and Haile Selassie and, you know, but also musically, he came from a more diverse background, as you say, Elijah, you know, so that Fats Waller was a big hit in the family, as well as, or My Blue Heaven, or, you know, and this was all stuff that, again, going back to my notes on my initial conversations with Mac, and maybe with my own dumbness, but I don't think, I mean, I could point to many aspects of my dumbness, but I don't think this was it. I don't think that Mac fully realized, you know, he had all the elements that are in Mrs. Anderson's book, which he got from Carrie, but I don't think he fully processed them. And that I think is probably the major part of I didn't want to in any way step on Mrs. Anderson's toes or the toes of the book you did with her, Preston. And so there's no allusion to the book, I think, except in terms of saying you've got to read this book at the end. You know, this is integral. But there was it definitely revised the thinking that I had. I mean, Mac talked about him going, you know, his being living in his father's house, but not to the extent that Mrs. Anderson describes, and not with an awareness of what the implications of that were. But taking it a step further, Elijah, you know, Johnny Shine saw Robert, you know, if he were alive today or alive when we were talking, you know, as being a kind of Wes Montgomery figure, somebody who had such a technical knowledge and appreciation of the guitar that he would have gone on to be, whether he would have been a jazz player or, you know, but somebody beyond T-Bone Walker, let's say. T-Bone Walker's pretty high up, so I don't mean I'm not trying to slur T-Bone
Walker. Well, in terms
Walker.
Of popularity, yes, he would have been hard to beat, but in terms of style, he could have gone in any number of directions, I think, with his ability.
Well, but John really felt that there was no question he would have gone into far more, you know, things that were far beyond the conventional bop to bop kind of blues, you know, which is something that,
right.
that John aspired to as well, but I don't think he had that. He was a wonderful slide player, but I don't think he had the full range of musical expression that Robert did.
Well, one of the painful aspects of the way that the recording business worked is that Robert Johnson could have already been there. We'll never know. He, as Elijah likes to point out, he recorded what he was recorded in his lane, so to speak, as a bluesman, while we've all since put together different aspects of this multi-layered genre eschewing repertoire that was absolutely vast, both in the realm of his own talent and in I think response to economic opportunities and having to be able to play everything to keep those nickels flying his direction on the street corner.
He was waiting for the Americana era to be born.
But he might have already done it. When we're talking about what he would have done, what else did he do that we don't know about? It's one of the, questions that can drive me happily crazy. Peter, you referenced Mrs. Anderson and Muddy Waters throughout our conversation, and there's this great story that I've heard from a number of different perspectives about, I believe it's you, Muddy Waters, and Mrs. Anderson. In what is it, a Boston club somewhere in the late 70s? Tell us about that.
Well, that may not have been the first time I laid eyes on Mrs. Anderson, because she was going around to the blues clubs then, and I was aware that she was living, I believe, in Western Massachusetts then. I could be wrong, but she would come in and I think stay at the Y, and she went to the blues clubs, but I don't know that I knew who she was. And this was at Paul's Mall, which is the other side of the Jazz Workshop. I mean, there were two rooms next to each other in Boston on Boylston Street. And I went to see Muddy Waters, and I'm quite sure I had taken my son Jake and a friend of his to come see I got special dispensation to bring them to see Muddy Waters. When I went backstage to see Muddy, Pinetop Perkins sat with them. He babysat them, to make sure. To make sure they didn't order a beer or anything. I didn't know Pinetop particularly. I mean, I don't mean in telling the story that I'm not trying to portray myself as having any role in that world or central. I would have liked to have, but I mean, it wasn't that. But anyway, Pinetop did sit with them,
fair enough.
And I remember Muddy came out afterwards, and and Jake's friend, Jesse, asked Muddy for his autograph. And I thought, oh, God, this is terrible, because Muddy, to all intents and purposes, didn't read or write. But as it turned out, he could write his autograph. And so he says, have you got anything for me to write on? And so Jesse came up with a cocktail napkin. And Muddy looked at it very dubiously, and he says, that's a mighty shitty little piece of paper to write my name on. But that was, I believe that was right after I had gone backstage, and or on the edge of backstage, and I went back to say hello to Muddy, I guess. I was thrilled if Muddy just said hello to me. I mean, I always introduced myself. I didn't think I had any, central role or any role at all in his life. But this one, and he was always very gracious, but I never felt that he was that thrilled to see me, as why should he be? And so I could barely get out who I was when he made it clear for maybe one of the few times that he knew who I was. And he says, there's, and he had a way of stammering kind of when he got excited. He says, there's this thing, I want you to see, man, you're not going to believe this. You're not going to believe this. And he says, show him what you got. And he said this to Mrs. Anderson. And Mrs. Anderson took out of her pocketbook her wallet or whatever, and took out a picture of Robert Johnson's, and Muddy saying, "You know who that is, man? You know," and I did know who it was, because even though the picture hadn't been published, I knew who it was because Mac had shown me pictures of Robert.
Oh, wow.
And
so none of the photos had been published at that point. Nobody had really seen them.
No, they didn't, there was no, I think the first photo that was published was in 86. This was 78. But, you know, you think I was going to spoil, I mean, I was so thrilled that Muddy was including me in this. And Mrs. Anderson, who I didn't know, was showing me this, and I just, and he says, that's Robert, man, that's Robert, you know, and it was just like my moment with Muddy Waters. And recently, I read a thing when Muddy died. I think I included this anecdote in the obituary that I wrote. I think that I wrote in Rolling Stone. But recently, Bob Margolin wrote a reminiscence. Somebody sent it to me, who was playing guitar. And he was there, too, so I don't want to leave him out of the... I don't remember him in the picture, but he
okay.
obviously was in the picture. So that was my first meeting with Mrs. Anderson. I'm sure she doesn't remember it, but it was a thrill for me.
Well, she does remember showing the photo to Muddy Waters.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
you know,
but she doesn't. I don't think she remembers me. Why would she?
We'll take that up with her another time, but
no, don't.
But no, that'll be that. Well, I think that's a terrific story, and that's so exciting to hear about Muddy Waters, you know, being a fanboy, for lack of a better term, about Robert Johnson.
He was just
being
totally
just as caught up in the mystique and the excitement of being able to see this photo as any of us would be.
No, I mean, and the thing was, Muddy was he was so regal. And if I say he was phlegmatic, it's not that he was without, but, you know, this was a very, I know that other people have seen him like that. I mean, I remember Eric Clapton telling me about riding around with Muddy on a, you know, with Muddy on a tricycle on a, you know, big over. And, you know, that's a picture of Muddy that I have never seen, you know, it just, But this was so unlike any other time that I saw Muddy, and Muddy conducted himself with such dignity, and he, as you say, he was just so excited, and Mrs. Anderson had brought that excitement to him.
Well, that was part one of our interview with Peter Guralnick. We are going to get back to it in just a moment, but first I wanted to discuss something that we're going to get to with Peter. First, Peter was profoundly influenced by the late Texas folklorist and researcher Mac McCormick, who became a legendary figure in his own right, if also a thorn in the side of my dear friend, Mrs. Annie C. Anderson. But Elijah, Mac is part of a long legacy of Robert Johnson researchers. Where does he fit in? And can you take us through some of that?
I think where Mac really starts forging his own path is an awful lot of what we call blues research was actually record research, was actually people hunting down records. And Mac was, as far as I can tell, not particularly interested in records. Mac was interested in people. And that really set him apart. I think he was perhaps the only early blues researcher who was not also a record collector. And, you know, he came to it, he was Lightnin' Hopkins's manager. I mean, he actually liked the direct contact with the people who were in that world. And so he went out, he had worked, I gather, as a detective. I'm not sure in exactly what respect before he got into doing this.
Was he a census taker?
Well, he did do census taking as a way of knocking on doors and finding people. But I'm pretty sure I remember that there was a moment when he had been a detective. In any case, he certainly behaved like a detective. And, you know, went out into the communities talking with people at length. I mean, he was apparently very good at that, at just sort of getting people talking and having conversations. And Robert Johnson, it's important to add, was one of many, many people who he investigated. I mean, he did most of his work in Texas and got very, very deep information about Texas blues players, not just guitarists, but a lot of the most amazing stuff he got was all the Texas barrel house piano players who interested him just as much. I mean, the amazing story that I remember is when Kip Lornell and Charles Wolfe were doing their book on Lead Belly, them finding a daughter Lead Belly had had while living under a different name. And I don't remember how they found her, but they found her and they got in to interview her and they finished the interview. And she said, you know, it's funny. There was a fella in here 20 years ago, came asking me all those same questions and went into her top drawer and pulled out Mac's card. He had never published a word. As far as I know, none of that particular research has surfaced. I mean, who knows what's in Mac's files? And who knows how much of it we'll ever be able to interpret. When I talked with him, he said a lot of what he had, a lot of his notes, a lot of his information would not make any sense without him there to explain it. And I hope he was wrong.
Yeah.
Because that's what we've got now, and we don't have him to explain it.
What did you make of the New York Times piece that went into Mac's archive seemingly without Mac's permission?
It went out completely without his permission.
I was absolutely stunned. Can you imagine if they had done that to an elderly Black person? I mean, they would have all been fired, and instead it became this, you know, celebrated triumph of culture. I was just scratching my head about the whole thing. I thought it was outrageous.
I have very mixed feelings about the whole thing. Because Mac always used to say, and I mean, he said this directly to me, and I know other people who he said it to, that he was keeping all of his files in a secret location. And if he wasn't given the funding to deal with them, he wasn't going to tell anyone where they were and they would disappear. I mean, Mac's position always was, as far as, not always, but I mean, in the later years, Mac would tell people that all of this stuff was going to die with him. And if you tell people for 30 years that all your research is going to die with you and you refuse to publish any of it, I absolutely, there's no question but that that article was based, this is the article on L.V. Thomas and Geechee Wiley. And there's no question but that was Mac's research, that it was spirited out of his hands under false pretenses by getting a researcher into his trust, that the researcher herself did not understand that material was going to be used without Mac's permission. I mean, the whole thing.
I didn't realize that.
That's my understanding. I mean, I'm not that deep into it either.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the messiness of it is unquestionable. The dishonesty, we can say all the nasty things we want to say about it. It also is true that Mac kept saying, you know, if my work doesn't get out there while, you know, if people don't fund me to get my work out there while I'm alive, it is going to disappear and forever. And yet kept not finishing anything or publishing anything.
Oh.
So, you know, it's really, really hard to come up with a clean moral judgment on that one.
Well, and I think that it passed muster at the end of the day, I guess, with the New York Times and with a lot of fans who accepted it as simply being a case of McCormick being McCormicked, that, you know, he had pulled these sorts of antics on people with whom he had worked. I worked closely with one of them, so I know that perspective. I'm not even saying that that's necessarily it. I'm just saying I think that that's, that was the justification, was that, you know, these stories, resources, and so on had been purloined, and so, you know.
Well, look.
Piracy Mac, against a pirate.
I don't think Mac was an evil man, but yeah. Mac was an extremely paranoid man.
Mm-hmm.
By the later years, some of that with good reason.
As it turns out.
And I think it also is important to say he was by no means alone in this belief, which was in fact standard with anthropologists of his generation. I mean, he was not an academic, but academics of his generation, it was absolutely standard for them to feel like if they didn't rescue and preserve,
yes,
the artifacts of primitive peoples,
right,
that
right,
the primitive
right,
peoples
right.
couldn't be trusted with those things.
You know, as we start, as we transition to our discussion with Peter about Mac McCormick, you know, what can we say at this point about the legacy of white blues researchers and the history of Robert Johnson?
Boy, that's a hard one. So much of what I know and you know and any of us know, we only know because of a lot of people who we might also have misgivings about. And I'm always trapped between where I feel like they did stuff that was inappropriate and where I realize I am infinitely indebted to them.
Right.
And you know, that's in a sense a version of the reaction I have when we talk about someone like Robert Johnson, who could sing, "I'm gonna beat my woman till I'm satisfied."
Well, that's not a
and
lyric we
I
often dissect.
I forgive him for that lyric because of other things. But should I? You know, this is not easy.
Well, maybe we ought to just leave it there and let Peter take it over. But let me first make it very clear that the son of Dr. Guralnik is an absolute gem. I mean, he's like the nicest, kindest, most ethical and positive person.
Absolutely.
Who I have encountered. So I would not in any way put him in this same sort of muck with Steve LeVere and gang. It's just such an interesting legacy. And the way that Peter intersected with Mac McCormick, who I think you described very fairly as a difficult guy, says a lot about Peter. And I think that that's just an interesting relationship that
you know,
get to examine.
Peter has always established and maintained very, very warm relationships
with Colonel Parker, you know,
with all sorts of complicated people, many of whom despise each other.
Right.
Yeah. No. And Peter is, as you say, a genuinely nice guy. He also, however, is not, you know, he's not a patsy. He knows Peter's interesting. Peter's a brilliant, complicated person. And I think what everybody is reacting to is that Peter deals very honestly with all of these people and genuinely is interested in all of these people and genuinely listens to them. And I think people respond to that, be they Colonel Parker or be they the musicians.
Right.
You know, he's always himself and he really, really cares about people and listens to them.
I think that did it. Kids, if you're at home, take notes. That's exactly how it's done. Here is the second half of our interview with Peter Guralnik.
I got an assignment from Rolling Stone to write a story about this research into Robert Johnson, which at this point, you know, was unknown, and the fact that photographs existed and had been found and that there was a whole history here. So that's what I went down to do. And he was very generous in terms of going over the material with me and showing portions of his manuscript, Biography of a Phantom, which he said at the time, you know, was very close to completion, and there were certain elements that needed to be pursued, but including whether or not was it Neshoba County was going to bring murder charges on the basis of the information that he had brought them to them about the murder of Robert Johnson in 1938. They didn't act on that information, but I think that I didn't have to say that. But he, in any case, so he spent, you know, a great deal of time with me over the couple of days, 2 or 3 days, and it was just so fascinating and so fabulous. And Elijah's right. He, you know, I think like any author or like anybody who devotes himself to a field, he undoubtedly felt that, you know, his more obscure work was just as important as the work that might reach a broader audience. But he was totally focused on the Robert Johnson. And I think that, you know, if you were, it seems to me that Mack had difficulty finishing things. And he himself said that he had, you know, periods of mental instability or just periods in, you know, depression, yeah. Let's say, deep depression.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the ways in which that it manifests itself was the inability to finish projects. Robert Johnson is not the only
yeah.
one. But there's no question that he had done a tremendous amount of work. He had no, there was no holdback on his part. He wasn't apologizing for it. He wasn't saying, as he was at the end of his life, well, maybe it's all completely untrue. He had the evidence, he had the interviews, he had the information, and was passionate about it. And I'm sorry that the book never came out. And what happened was, you know, as time went on, and you can go back and you may well have more questions to ask about this. I stayed in touch with Mac, you know, from that time off and on until, you know, until he died. When after a period of time he hadn't published anything, and in fact what precipitated my writing the essay that became, you know, the little book that is Searching for Robert Johnson was Alan Greenberg had written a film script called Love in Vain, and it appeared as
yeah.
about Robert Johnson, and it appeared as if that was going to be filmed, and he had gotten great encouragement from Martin Scorsese, and I mean, it was a real thing, but like so many things in the tinsel world, real things don't necessarily materialize.
Mm-hmm.
And but so he was having his this script for his film being, it was going to be published by Doubleday, I think, as a paperback, maybe by Marie Brown as the editor. And he asked me to write an introduction. Because I had been working with him, you know, not formally, but just in terms of brainstorming during that time. And so what I thought was, well, this is a chance to write a real thing about Robert Johnson. And I got in touch with Mac, and I said, you know, I'd like to use some of the material, because there was so much material he had conveyed to me. I'd like to use some of the material to write, you know, a biographical essay about Robert Johnson. And he said, absolutely, anything that I gave you, you know, you can use. I said, well, I don't want to step on your toes. And, you know, he said, no, you wouldn't be. And so I did. I mean, I wrote this. And it turned out to be, of course, completely unsuitable as an introduction. It was 30,000 words. And, you know, I didn't mean it in any way you know, I didn't mean to be overbearing. And I didn't mean it as an insult. Once I got going, and I had the idea of, you know, bringing in interviews I'd done with Johnny Shines separately, and Johnny Shines and Robert Jr. Lockwood together. Maybe I did that for this. I can't remember. But and I just wrote everything that I, you know, had to say. And Alan, I think quite properly, Alan Greenberg, the author of the screenplay, thought this wasn't really appropriate as an introduction, and I agreed. And then I published it in Living Blues, I think, in 82. That was the first place it was published. So anyway, that's sort of my background with Mac McCormick. But he was so dedicated to this research and so dedicated to the story in a way that was certainly different from, you know, my own approach to things, but that had its own, the thing that most impressed me about Mac was he was just such an incredible writer. And you read his Ragtime Henry Thomas liner notes. I think that was a Herwin fold-out double album, mm-hmm. maybe single. And they're just so brilliant. They're so imaginative. And his mind was, you know, maybe this is one of the problems he had, was he certainly had many fears, or if that's too strong a word, then I'll try to modify it. But, you know, he and they were based to some extent on the imagination, to some extent on realistic concerns. I don't mean fears of me, but just I'm talking about in the world, in life. And but as a writer, I thought he was so imaginative, and that's why I thought and think to this day that the book that he wrote, and I'm sure he never finished it, but I also know there is enough manuscript. All I'm saying is just that from my perspective, and it doesn't have to be anybody else's, Mac McCormick was not just a major researcher, but a great writer in what he did complete, mm-hmm. or what he was able to. And from what, you know, from what little I saw of the book Biography of a Phantom, and it was little. He didn't say, here, take the whole manuscript, you know, back to your hotel with you and, mm-hmm. you know, read it overnight. And that, I didn't have that opportunity. But it showed such remarkable promise and cohesion and suspense and excitement. And that's the book I'd like to read.
Well, I was very impressed with, in being reminded of this fact, looking at Searching again, with Mac's search for the killer and trying to bring the killer to justice.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that he thought he knew who had done it. I didn't realize that things had progressed in that particular direction. And so I thought that was really fascinating. And another issue that Mac was aware of early on and shared with you to some extent that you reported in Searching was of, I guess, Claude Johnson. Is that right? Did Mac locate Claude Johnson?
I mean, Mac had a picture of Claude Johnson. I don't understand why this never entered into the legal case. And
yeah.
I did not realize that until I did this revised version of the book last year. I was not fully aware that he was describing Claude Johnson because I didn't have biographical information on Claude Johnson. But at the end of our time together, he showed me four pictures, and one was of, you know, Robert Johnson's mother. One was of his brother. One was of Robert with his nephew Lewis, and one was of his son, taken in 1970. And he didn't give me a name. He gave me biographical information. This I rewrote slightly in the, in the revised edition that came out last year. But and the biographical information is totally consonant with the biographical information of Claude Johnson, who was eventually declared the heir of Robert Johnson on the basis of much more peripheral mm-hmm. testimony, I would say.
Right.
I was astonished. He was in Gravel Springs, I think. Wasn't he living in Gravel Springs?
Yep.
And I was just astonished in rewriting it.
Oh, no,
now.
Sorry. Crystal Springs. But he was in the gravel business. Gravel Springs is up in Otha Turner country in North Mississippi.
See how we can mix things up, or I can mix things up. You,
well,
you
that's
keep,
an
you
easy one,
things.
Peter.
But anyway, no. So in reconsidering the matter when I rewrote it, and again, I wouldn't expect anybody to notice the difference, but it really made a strong case for Claude Johnson without any question, at least from Mac's research.
That's why I brought it up. I mean, that's a massive gap. And, you know, working with Mrs. Anderson, of course I'm biased. She's my friend. I really care about her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been done dirty, regardless of whether or not Robert fathered Claude Johnson. But the proof that was offered in court, at least, of the parentage was not good enough, and the timing was highly suspicious.
Right.
You know, to have someone come forward at the last minute when there's $1 million on the line and say, oh, yeah, but if Mac actually knew him back then and had harder information and had spent more time, which it sounds like he would have, how on earth did that not come to light?
I'm not asking you.
I'm just saying, wow, that's unbelievable.
Well,
that's shocking, in a certain sense,
I heard from so many lawyers over the years about various peripheral Robert Johnson issues, and I don't understand how nobody ever picked up on the fact that this was in the book, which they were calling me about. I mean, they were calling me thinking that I knew all these things that weren't in the book. Well, this was in the book,
right.
And this had real relevance, and, you know, for somebody to claim, somebody whose last name was Johnson, and who basically provided the same information that, Up Jumped the Devil, has in recent years, or maybe other books too, about the birth of this child to Robert's, well, she didn't marry him, but to the
mm-hmm.
young woman whom Robert hooked up with towards the end of his life. There was all this information that there was a direct correlation, and it was provided at a time in 1970 when Robert Johnson's name and work were simply not worth exploiting. I mean, nobody would manufacture that kind of story, because the person who was providing it is asking, is there any money in it? Which there wasn't,
Well, Steve Levere thought there was. He was certainly on that.
But the money did not eventuate until 20 years
mm-hmm.
later.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
So yeah, it shows you how dumb I was, though. I mean, I read about Claude Johnson. I read the evidence that was put forward, that someone was witness to Robert, getting together with Claude Johnson's mother in the field and stuff, and so she knew that Claude Johnson was the son. None of this was very compelling, and the whole legal case was rather, it's kind of disturbing on a certain... I mean, it wasn't that I thought an injustice has been perpetrated. I just didn't think it had anything to do with justice or injustice from what I could read. And then here was this actual testimony in something that I had written totally unwittingly. They're always talking about whether somebody was a witting or unwitting ally of Putin, whether Trump was witting or unwitting. Well, I was unwitting here, but it's there.
Well, and, to piggyback on that, Peter, you mentioned children, plural, and widow. Well, that's the exact language that appears in some of McCormick's correspondence with Columbia that I've seen from
mm-hmm.
Mrs. Anderson's files. And it was put across at that point in a fashion that just seemed totally dubious. But, I mean, do you remember, were there multiple...
I could never chase any of that down, and I tried to contend with that a little in this revised edition, but I have no basis on which to contend with it, I don't know. I didn't pursue it with Mac. I never learned anything else, and so I just don't know. The one thing that I realized was he was talking about Claude Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And that
yeah.
is no,
no it dawned on me.
Yeah.
Well, I did the math right there when reading your book, knowing that Claude was born in, 31? And sure enough, it made sense.
39 years old. But I had no idea who Claude Johnson was when I wrote Searching for Robert Johnson.
Right. No, he had not been part of the story at all at that point.
No, no. And Mac was very, very careful not to name him. So I don't want to dwell on this. I don't mean to dwell on this too much. I mean, it's not. But it's an example of ways in which Mac lived in a world that was somewhat apart from the world that is the passionate and sometimes dyspeptic world of blues research.
When you were hearing Robert Johnson for the first time, unlike many people who've come after you,
mm-hmm.
We've by now had several generations of fans who they may know more facts about Robert Johnson, but they never met anyone from that world.
Right.
They never got to see Skip James. They never got to see Sun House. They never even got to see Howlin' Wolf or Muddy Waters. And when you got interested in this, there were a lot of people from that world still walking around. Indeed, mm-hmm. they were still walking around and were many of them younger than you or I am now. And I'm just interested how it affected your understanding of the music, that there were not just records, but people around.
Well, this is what, it's not what drew me to the music, but it's what I found was the most honest way that I could describe the music, reflect upon the music, and offer up my own experience of the music was through drawing portraits of the people who made the music, like Johnny Shines, like Robert Junior Lockwood, you know, like Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf. And so for me, I mean, it's just, you know, everything I've ever written, and the Robert Johnson would be maybe the poorest example of it, but everything I've ever written has been an attempt to write about the subject from the inside out. I'm not interested in writing from Olympian Heights. I'm not interested in being, you know, the arbiter of all things. And so meeting someone like Johnny Shines, who became a good friend, and I met him in, you could probably tell me, it's either 69 or 70, I think 69. It was when the Chicago Blues All-Stars went out. It was 69 or 70. And it was so extraordinary talking to this person with his own poetic sensibility, talking to someone about what it was like to go out there, and him saying, you know what it's like to live in an exploratory world. It's very exciting. And I'm thinking, yeah, man, that is so true. I mean, that's what I aspire to live in an exploratory world. It's what I still aspire to. It's what we should all aspire to, you know, a world in which everything, you know, is new and fresh every day. And in his case, it was because it was new and fresh because you were off to another town. And as he spoke about Robert Johnson, and he spoke about the life, and as he spoke about the blues, there was nothing, reflexive about it. There wasn't anything that was just everyday about it. And so, yeah, that was a portrait of Robert Johnson, a particular portrait. Now, it's interesting because Mrs. Anderson says nothing that people like Johnny Shines or Robert Junior Lockwood said reflects in any way my experience with Robert. With my brother, Robert, then she says, well, I didn't have him in my pocket, which is such a great expression. I never heard anybody else say it. Maybe it's a common expression. And, of course, he didn't have her in his pocket either. And so she didn't see him. She doesn't totally deny what people like Johnny Shines say about her you know, brother, but in another way, she doesn't altogether believe it. And then talking to Johnny Shines about Robert, and he says he never spoke about his people. He never spoke about his family. He never spoke mm-hmm. about living in Memphis. So it's such, I mean, this is a guy who and this is what Mac McCormick, I think, appreciated most about Robert Johnson, was the degree to which he compartmentalized his life. It was the mystery mm-hmm. of Robert Johnson. And not everybody does that. I mean, somebody like Johnny Shines, I don't think was like that, for better or worse. I mean, he was, again, Johnny Shines was someone of great sensibility, of who had, taught himself to read I think after he arrived in Chicago, as I recall, who was an avid reader, who was curious about the world around him. But he didn't compartmentalize in quite the way. We all compartmentalize to some degree. He did not in the way that, and very few do in the way that Robert Johnson did, which is one of the things that I think that created the mystery of Robert Johnson, which was so different from the story of so many of the other blues singers.
Well, that wraps it up for our interview with Peter Guralnick. I hope that y'all enjoyed it. I hope that you will subscribe, like, favorably comment, share with friends. We accept all forms of positive feedback, and I hope that you will join us next time when we go deep with Larry Cohn into the making of the complete Robert Johnson Recordings box set. Till then.